since it's the recent start of the Chinese New Year and the Year of the Dragon, I thought we could take a ride on another magical serpent. The Ouroboros is probably the most pervasive and enduring ancient mythological symbol depicting a serpent or, as we'll see, a dragon eating its own tail in the shape of a circle. It continues to impress people the world over as it grows in popularity among tattoos and in jewelry designs. But its origins are hazy because the iconography surfaced in numerous civilizations, widespread civilizations, in similar times. From Yoruba mythology of Western Africa, depictions of the snake eating its tail, and in this cosmology, all the forces of the universe were created by a single supreme being, most often known as Olufin, or Olurun, or Olodumare, who's a genderless creator god, all-knowing, all-powerful, and eternal. The dragon, Ouroboros, can be seen on the pottery of ancient China among the Yang Shao culture along the Yellow River. And this dates back to between 5,000 and 3,000 BC and other parts of East Asia, like the Hongshan culture of Mongolia, where river jade dragons in the form of a C-shape have been unearthed from the Neolithic period, which goes as far back as 7,000 BC. The etymology of this word, Ouroboros, is interesting, traces back to Greek. Oro means tail, boros means eating. And this word is strikingly similar to the Aurora Borealis, right? But Aurora Borealis is Latin and means something totally different. It comes from the Roman goddess Aurora, the goddess of the dawn. It may be entirely coincidental that phonetically that this is very similar, but nonetheless, we could imagine ancient people looking up at the night sky, enthralled by the dancing northern lights, and they could have actually bared witness to different colorful patterns, and sometimes green, moving in spiral fashions and determining in their minds that this is some kind of cosmic serpent. Because when you combine that with the possibility of ancient people uncovering dinosaur bones, well, then a mysterious and fantastical world unfolds where dragons do exist and persist. In Aboriginal mythology of Indigenous Australia, the rainbow serpent is a key part of what's known as the Dreamtime, which is their central framework of cosmology and spirituality. And I don't know much about the Dreamtime, other than to say that the rainbow serpent is also seen as a creator god, associated with water in the form of rain and rivers, and sometimes with creation and destruction, just like the Ouroboros. It's often depicted as a giant serpentine creature that moves across the land with its body forming the landscape, mountains and rivers. Because if you think about the pattern of mountains, it has a snake-like shape, and the pattern of rivers, if we look from above, has a snake-like formation. And that movement is also believed to cause the weather, the storms, which rejuvenate the earth. So this is to add to the cyclical motif of the one entering the all and the all contained in the one, and also how the heavens greatly influenced early religious attitudes and Mother Nature as both creative and destructive. This symbolism and name, Ouroboros, were adopted in the early centuries of the Common Era, but the concept itself predates its Greek naming, having appeared in the Egyptian hieroglyphics as well. And images of the Ouroboros snake were discovered in King Tutankhamun's tomb. The icon entered our Western models of thought via Greek magical traditions and was adopted as a symbol of Gnosticism, alchemy, and various other philosophical systems. But why this snake, or why is the dragon ubiquitous from Arthurian legend to ancient China, or the serpent? What makes the zoological and cryptozoological theme so ubiquitous? I think there's something archetypal and ominous about the dragon or a snake. Anthropologists hypothesize that snakes may have been the only significant predator for our primate predecessors. To this day, in the civilization of the Akta people of Southeast Asia, they still suffer high rates of python attacks and related deaths. So according to evolutionary biology, this accounts for our sensitivity to the color green. If you just look out the window when you get a chance and pay attention to which color is the most salient, you'll probably notice that you can detect many more shades of green and it appears more vibrant to your eyes. And its salience was for detecting snakes and being able to distinguish the motion of grass from the slithering pattern of the snake so that we could survive. There's the snake, obviously, in the story of Genesis and the Garden of Eden, representing Satan, or the tempting of God consciousness down into ego consciousness, which was portrayed by Adam and Eve feeling shame around their nakedness and the self-consciousness of their bodies, which previously they were in an enlightened state. In Hindu mythology, there are the Nagas, or sacred serpents, and Ananta is the king of all the Nagas, and one of the primal beings of the creation myths. Ananta is a massive serpent with 1,000 heads upon which the god Vishnu reclines, and Vishnu is known in the Hindu trinity as the sustainer. So Ananta's role is to support the whole universe and often seen floating in this cosmic ocean, symbolizing the stability and foundation for the cosmos. And while there may not be depictions of Ananta eating its own tail, the imagery of Vishnu on the serpent and the cyclical nature of creation, preservation, and dissolution in Hindu cosmology shares the thematic parallels with the circuitous presentation of the Ouroboros. And another related concept in the Vedic philosophy of India is the Samudra Manthan, or the churning of the ocean of milk. This is a story, a Hindu myth that describes a scene where the gods, known as the Devas, and the demons, or the Asuras, work together to churn the ocean to obtain Amrita, which is the nectar of immortality, which is kind of similar to the quest for the Holy Grail or the elixir of eternal life in European mythology. The serpent in this story is Vasuki, and the serpent or snake is used, offers itself as a rope to be wrapped around the mountain Mandara. And then the gods and the demons pull both ends of the snake to churn the ocean. So again, while Vasuki is not necessarily eating its own tail in this story, it still highlights the cosmic significance of serpents and the themes of struggle, polarity, balance, the dialectics of light and dark and good versus evil and the quest for eternal life, which all resonates with some of the existential themes of the Ouroboros in Gnosticism. So for the mystics and Gnostics, I don't think the Ouroboros was good or bad, but maybe expressed to them the hermetic principle of polarity, with the tail merging with the head, indicating the balance of the pairs of opposites, top and the bottom, the positive and the negative charges. The circular form symbolizes infinity, because in a circle, there's no clear starting point, and before and after are all relative as you move or trace around a circle, and so can represent no beginning or no end and non-linear time. Also, the paradox of the self can be encoded in the metabolic function of digestion. because biting and eating implies digestion in the gut, which is simultaneously regenerative and degenerative depending on the point of view, right? It nourishes the eater while devouring the eaten. The Ouroboros is emphatic self-digestion, could be an esoteric and superconscious insight of the self-consumption of the universe. If matter is ultimately consciousness frozen or condensed, like the matter in our dreams, we see people, we see things, we see distance, but not exactly like that, but just to relate the notion that consciousness could permeate everything. Well, then the so-called physical world gives a way for consciousness to perceive itself, i.e. to consume itself. But the yogi emulates this with self-reflexivity, which leads to self-transcendence or self-disillusion. As the more our mind seeks the self, or the origin of the self, or the seed of the self, the less support it finds, or the less theoretical substrate remains for the mind to exist in the first place. Or more succinctly, the relentless hunt for the ego eventually makes it go extinct. In herpetology, a snake biting or eating its own tail would not be normal behavior. This would be unusual and rare, but it has been documented and attributed to stress or trauma or intense body temperature. So I'll put my own spin on this here. The world that we inhabit is traumatizing and violent and collectively triggers compulsive self-digestion or self-harm as addiction to futility. This could explain the technological progress that's both constructive and destructive. For example, we invent cars and then move farther away from work and family and loved ones, which demands faster transportation, which then results in further travel and distance. Or social media connects people remotely so they can be with each other less, which makes people lonely, so they consume more social media. But the connection is shallower, so it has to be used more compulsively. But then people are less present and less likely to relate deeper in person, which makes them more lonesome. And we build structures out of the materials of the earth. But then those inventions need energy to be maintained. So we extract fuel from the earth, which leads to more products, which leads to more energy demand, and then more products to extract the energy, which leads to disposable goods, which leads to toxic waste and environmental crisis, or the dragon consuming itself. But this wasn't the pattern for many indigenous wisdom cultures, or the Gnostics, or yogis, or mystics. They weren't putting the planet on an extinction course. But I think this is the core feature of renunciation or any reclusive pattern, or just living simply. It's the unplugging of the tail from the mouth. On the individual level, our wounds of shame, betrayal, or abandonment can have those generative and degenerative imprints in our psyche when there are barriers to healing or justice or transformation. And that could manifest as symptoms of need for approval, which is cyclical, or people pleasing, which is like chasing our own tail, fear of rejection, the pursuit of vengeance, having to prove one's worth, or self-esteem based externally, and ambition or self-harm. Why doesn't a snake release the bite when it feels the pain? I think that self-harm, because it releases endorphins, masks the pain and conflates it with gain or control. But then more harm is needed to generate the same relief, which makes it like addiction, albeit without ingesting substances. But the neurochemical effect is still achieved. And this involves maybe the darker side of the Ouroboros, Additionally, I see the head of the snake as representing the hegemon in society, the top of the class, the top of the pyramid structure, feeling itself as separate from the lower class and biting into the oppressed, not realizing how it's destroying itself. Mark Twain wrote, "Freedom is like a bag of sand. If there's a hole anywhere in the bag, all the sand will run out. If any group of our people are denied their rights, sooner or later, all groups stand to lose their rights. All the freedom will run out." While not perfect, it's amazing how ahead of his time Mark Twain was, born in 1810. Abolitionist, pro-women suffrage, anti-imperialist. Not immediately, but how he contended with his own beliefs, I think, is admirable. And celebrities or authors or artists today would have to go so much further in terms of challenging the status quo than almost anybody is willing to do today in order to protect their privilege. But with inflation of the ego, the self is so psychically siloed off from community that there's no sense of community. Maybe our enemies of the earth are projecting their traumas or hiding from their shadow, but they don't see how they negatively impact the whole, which includes them. So now military offense is framed as defense, and taking life is for protecting life. And governments like ours have endless money to kill, but never enough to live. Never enough resources for the people. And every animate and inanimate thing, when under this spell of the dark side of the Ouroboros, looks only like a resource. The animal is no longer perceived as a miracle of sentience with its own purpose and unique way of life, but merely as a means to an end. The animal is food, it's clothing, it's for lab testing, it's to be grown and tortured in factories. The tree is not a living natural wonder, but wood or paper or fuel. And all trees then can be rationally and systematically removed from every corner of the earth and then regrown in a perverse, unaesthetic manner so that they aren't a forest, but a farm. And humans, we're not exempt from this deranged exploitation because the human is situated within an organization, an employer, a company, a society, a neighborhood, a country. We're born typically within an organization and we die either in one or with the assistance of one. And in between, we continuously engage as representatives of organizations, and within organizations, interacting with organizations. So when it comes to work, whether we're in a nonprofit pattern or a for-profit, there's still something contradictory, like the Ouroboros, as the nonprofit with its mission would obviate its reason to exist if it truly succeeds. While the other side of this binary, capitalistic for-profit organizations require that the wages and time trap the employees on this treadmill where there's enough to live, but not enough to live without the work. And the person is often really relegated to a unit of expected energy for specific production, not in a spontaneous and autonomously creative human way, but in a forced, molded, patterned kind of work, a link in the supply chain. So another glitch in this matrix to break this cycle is genuine kindness, or as the French mystic and author Simone Weil wrote, pain and suffering are a kind of currency passed from one hand to hand until they reach someone who receives them but does not pass them on. So according to Norse mythology, when Jormungandr, which is a cosmic dragon or snake or serpent, wrapping Midgard or Middle Earth. When it releases its tail, then Ragnarok, the end of the world, begins. And certainly to break out of this cycle is the end of your world as you know it. Schopenhauer The pessimistic philosopher described the world as a will, not a personal will like free will, but as an engine of sorts that keeps the collective constantly in ambition and progress that leads to despair. The wheel of samsara in Buddhism, I think, inspired this. And the snake shedding its skin is the renewal of this process, or the transmigration of the soul, or reincarnation. But Schopenhauer believed that asceticism, which is just denying one's participation in the game, which then means your needs may or may not get met, but you aren't going to eat your own tail. But this form of austerity was seen by Schopenhauer as too extreme or too tough for most people. And therefore, this philosophy overall is pessimistic because it's equated with like a prison. We get sentenced to it. We don't really get to decide when we leave, and we're confined in a limited way in between. Although the Buddha prescribed a self-inquiry or self-consumption until anatta or no self is revealed, as in no ego that strives and suffers like the Ouroboros. Back to the side of earning and being in the machine, like most of us, can someone at least become content? If someone can truly say, this is enough, I have enough. Otherwise, any success invites growth, which expands your responsibility, and so on. In yoga, the kundalini power that we've discussed in sessions before is expressed as a coiled serpent at the base of the spine. And whether or not it's eating its own tail, the metaphor is somewhat literal and interesting to relate to uncoiling or breaking the cycle and then unleashing our spiritual power and restoring our totality, our sense of connection with the divine. In Greek rhetoric, from Aristotle's treatise on rhetoric, there are four concepts for persuasion: ethos, pathos, logos, and kairos. And these also kind of mimic the arc of the Ouroboros. And there's also a parallel in Hindu spirituality. Pathos appeals to emotions, and for some time we're guided by passion, desire, anger. Like the temperature of the snake could represent anger when it bites its tail. In anger or depression, we hurt others and ourselves. But pathos can also mean love and ambition and goals. And this is kama in Hinduism. Kama is desire or love. Love is in feeling good. The Ouroboros, in its self-consuming action, embodies this intensity. And then logos is meaning, like logic or logotherapy from Viktor Frankl, which is finding meaning in our suffering. And this parallels artha in Hinduism. Artha means having a goal, a logical reason, like to have a family, to earn wealth, to have prosperity, to deal with our practical affairs and the pursuit of resources for security and stability. That's logical. Siddhartha, the Buddha's name, breaks down to the goal of perfection, which led to Buddhahood. So inherently has, you know, contains the hero's journey. And then there is ethos and dharma. Ethos is a schema for righteousness. What is one where we get ethics? It comes from ethos. And dharma refers to righteous living, or living in harmony with the earth and nature. And then the last one is kairos and moksha in Indian spirituality. Kairos is the opportune moment or divine timing. And it finds its echo in the concept of moksha or liberation, which is the release from the cycles of birth, death, and rebirth, or the uncoiling of the serpent, or the removing of the tail from the mouth of the Ouroboros. And so this is a symbol for enlightenment. And kairos, that root sound and the prefix kai, also has a similar word in Sanskrit, kaivalya, which more indicates the breaking out or the transcendence of linear time. last thing I want to share is this motif of the Ouroboros may serve as a metaphor for our understanding of the evolution and potential fate of our universe. Again, representing the cyclical nature of existence, it mirrors the journey from the universe's inception, from a singularity, akin to the pinpoint of a snake's tail, which then expands like the Big Bang. And through this unfolding into multiplicity, complexity, and consciousness, which ultimately symbolized by the serpent's head. This meditation, for me, makes me wonder whether the universe, like the Ouroboros, contains the seeds of its own destruction. And has this cycle of rebirth and dissolution of the entire universe already occurred? How many times? Is what we perceive as the linear progression of time also an illusion, with the true nature of existence being non-linear, and maybe even non-local or atemporal? And expanding this metaphor to encompass the four fundamental forces of the universe, gravity, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear forces within the quantum realm, we can see a transition like this arc of the Ouroboros from microscopic physics at the serpent's tail, where our sense of gravity plays an inconsequential role compared to the dominant strong and weak nuclear forces and electromagnetism inside of the atom. And then you scale this out to the mesoscopic experience of reality within our daily lives. Here, we could say in the serpent's body, so to speak, we navigate and manipulate the force of gravity and electromagnetism in every action. From the mundane to the extraordinary, we're contending and sometimes collaborating with gravity to move or rest our bodies in work, play, travel, through to cars and through planes, and in sleep, when we're held by the earth. And as we extend this out to the serpent's head, we would encounter macrophysics, the realm of galactic clusters and the vast emptiness of the cosmos. In this domain, gravity and electromagnetism reign supreme, and they shape the universe's structure and guide the dance of celestial bodies. The forces that seem so potent on our scale, such as the destructive power of nuclear weapons, which are capable of decimating entire cities and even the Earth itself, become imperceptible against the backdrop of cosmic scales and the farthest reaches of space, where matter doesn't matter. An atomic explosion, with all its terrestrial fury, would scarcely disturb this dance in outer space, where gravity and electromagnetic forces are choreographing the movement of galaxies and the fabric of space-time itself. It'd be like taking a road trip across the country and trying to avoid an amoeba. And we sit somehow neatly in the middle of the extremes of our knowledge. The Planck length, the shortest measurement that our instruments can detect, is about 10 to the minus 35th power. And it has an almost symmetrical opposite extreme, which is the distance of the universe that we've been able to measure, which is 93 billion light years, I believe, or approximately 10 to the 27th power in meters. And either by divine intelligence, we're situated in the middle, or perhaps as we create new devices to probe the quantum realm and the macro realm, we may find that that's always what happens. We are situated in the middle of the cosmic scales. But I also wonder if that's where consciousness resides, somehow, like in this middle point. But also, that symmetry, I think, is reflective of the Tao Te Ching in China and the wisdom of Lao Tzu with no beginning, no end, the relativity of up and down, left and right. And also, I was looking at this book of mine, The Art of Peace, which has an Enso, a Japanese swoosh, you could say. And it was painted by the author, Morihei Ueshiba, who's one of Japan's greatest martial artists and also a calligrapher. But when I glanced at it this morning, I noticed that symbol looks like a snake. And at the end, there's kind of a head that looks like it could be chasing the tail. But this symbol represents emptiness and the self-perpetuation of the universe, but also Satori, or enlightenment. So this exploration reveals the paradoxical and multidimensional nature of existence, the relativity of significance and force, where phenomena that dominate one realm of reality becomes negligible or takes on a new meaning in another. The Ouroboros illustrates the intricate layering of reality, and it's amazing to dream of what all could be possible. Let's reflect on our understanding of time, causality, and the interconnectedness of all things, and our place within the universe, and the mysteries of our existence, realizing that it may be far more complex and intertwined than we can currently comprehend. And it challenges us to see beyond our conventions.